My name is Mark Griffin. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mark.
It always amazes me that we read that we do not engage in any controversies, and we are in the business of radically changing the lives of the most controversial people on the planet, active alcoholics. How that works out, I'm not sure I understand, but it does. I need to tell you, first of all, that my sobriety date is April the 2nd of 1993, and I can tell you that by the grace of God and His gift to this program. I don't take a whole lot of credit for it. I do a few things well, and they were what I was taught when I came in here. The first one of which is to show up, get a sponsor, get a home group. I'm one of those people that hates change. The second meeting I ever went to, I found a home group. It's been my home group for the last 16 years. The second guy I talked to in Alcoholics Anonymous became my sponsor. He's been my sponsor for 16 years. If they don't move that building, or him, I'm sure in 20 years, I'll be able to tell you the same thing. It's interesting you start your meeting a little bit differently than some other places. And I've been to AA all over the country, and every place is a little bit different, but we get the same message across. But I'm often reminded of what they say the last seven words of any organization are, and that is, we've never done it like this before. And, you know, it's true. I mean, AA is not so organized that we have to have a ritual. I mean, it's not the Catholic Church. Nothing against the Catholic Church. I belong. But I know that wherever I go in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a seat with my name on it, and I earned a right to be there. And from Nevada to Rock Springs, Wyoming, to New England, to Richmond, Virginia, to here, the message is the same. And it's a real simple message. It didn't strike me as being simple when I got here. I got to tell you that. When I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was terrified. And I was angry. And the only thing I was angry about was the fact that I knew I couldn't drink anymore. Because I lived my life as an active alcoholic without shame or remorse and in full agreement with the fact that what I was doing was my own business. I'm not hurting anybody else, which is the great white lie that we always tell ourselves. A lot of the characteristics I have as an alcoholic I had long before I ever took the first drink. I can remember I grew up in a small town in northwest Iowa, which is about as Opie Taylor-like an existence as you could want to grow up in the late 50s and early 60s. When I was about 4 years old, I had this habit of leaving the house, and every mom was a stay-at-home mom in Esterville, Iowa. There were no others. And I would just take off down the street, and I would knock on doors. And the housewife would answer the door, and I'd simply say, "Can I have a cookie?" And if I didn't get one there, I'd go to the next house. But somehow I knew I was entitled to a cookie, and I also knew that if I asked often enough, I'd get exactly what I wanted. And that attitude is an attitude I took throughout my entire life. First of all, I believed that I was entitled to it, and second of all, I believed that if I really wanted it, I'd find a way to get it. I didn't start drinking too awfully early. I went through a series of changes. We went from this small little town in Esterville, Iowa, to Jackson, Mississippi in 1965 in the midst of, you know, radical change in our society. But I went through four schools in three states in 2 years. And I was always the smallest kid in every class. In the seventh grade, I was 4'11", and I weighed 98 pounds. In 35 years, I've grown 9 inches and gained 102 pounds. But I was always looking for a way to protect my interest. I didn't really want to fit in so much as I just didn't want to be picked on. And my regular scheme was to go to a school and find a guy to fight, and fight just so nobody bothered me, and then get on with life. And the last time I tried this, I picked someone who was entirely too large to accomplish my mission and just got tattooed by this fellow. So I made a conscious decision. This is what alcoholics do, is I would search out the people that could get in trouble and get away with it. Everybody could tell the losers that they got caught for doing stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, they were always in the principal's office or getting expelled, suspended. I wanted people that could have fun and not get caught. And it took me a while, but I found them. And these are the people that taught me how to smoke and how to cut class and how to shoplift and do all the other things that were important to me to kind of fit in a little bit with a few people. You know, I think I'd come to a decision at that point in my life at the age of 13 where I categorized people in two ways. You were either stupid or weird. And I didn't want to hang around with the stupid people. They were people that did exactly what they were supposed to do. They were dull. They were accomplishing things like perfect attendance awards. I wanted people that were just a little strange and that were interesting to hang out with. And by God, must be alcoholic in me, but I found them. When I was 15 years old, I convinced a waiter in a restaurant I was bussing tables at to buy me a fifth of rum. And that night, my best friend and I drank that fifth of rum. And it was an interesting experience. I will tell you that it was the first true spiritual phenomenon of my life. And I had been raised in the church. I was raised a Presbyterian, as a matter of fact. But we got this fifth of rum, and we didn't have anything to mix it with. And I didn't know anything about eating food before, during, or after, or anything else. We just drank the rum. And I have never felt that good in my life. May not have felt that good since then. It was just absolutely wonderful. I chased that feeling for a lot of years. And nothing bad happened. I didn't do anything too stupid. I didn't get sick. I didn't have a hangover. My best friend had the exact opposite reaction. And, you know, by midnight, he was on his knees in the bathroom saying that prayer that eventually we would all say, which is, God, if you'll stop this, I'll never do this again. He ended up being an alcoholic, and I guess that's good for him, because if you're going to get sick every time from the first time you drink, I mean, you know, what fun is that? But I knew deep in my little heart that life had changed. Life had changed considerably at that point on. And I spent the next 22 years drinking as often as I wanted, as much as I could. And I got to tell you that it wasn't all horrible. I mean, we all have our little ups and downs in drinking. If you drink enough, eventually you're going to humiliate yourself in public, screw your job up, do something. I mean, it just happens. It's part of being an alcoholic. But by and large, the good times outweigh the bad times several fold. Or I guess I should better put this, there was no consequence that was so great that it was going to stop me from drinking and doing what I wanted. I tried college for a year after I negotiated my way out of high school. I was flunking Algebra 1 for the third consecutive year. And it's amazing. I mean, I had people cheating for me, and I still couldn't pass tests in Algebra 1. There's some lock in my brain. And one day the principal called me down. This is about 3 weeks, 5 weeks before the end of school. And he said, Mark, you know you're not going to graduate. And I said, well, I kind of figured that. He said, you understand that you're going to have to go to summer school. And I said, no, actually I'm not. I'm going to Europe. And I had. I'd worked my little hind end off all year long so I could afford to go to Europe with a friend. I said, so I'll come back to school every day next year to take one course if that's what you want me to do. And he didn't want me in school for another year, so we negotiated. And the deal was if I could pass Algebra 1, the final exam, they would go ahead and let me graduate. Now, this is the alcoholic in me. When the stakes are high enough, something that I have been failing for 3 solid years, I managed to learn in 5 weeks. Took the final exam on the day of graduation, walked out of there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was going to graduate. This is how I run my life as an alcoholic. This is how I'm in constant opposition to doing anything the way normal people would do it. When it came to school, I really prospered when there were finally no rules. I prospered much better my last year in college as a philosophy major, never showing up to class and simply turning in papers, which I could do at the 11th hour of the 11th day. Then I did showing up in class every day for some professor that felt it was necessary to see my face to be assured I had an education. But I didn't want to go to college. What I wanted to do was go into the work. I wanted to be a freestanding member of society. I just wanted to be able to go and do what I wanted to do, which meant drink. I went to work for the now defunct Richmond News Leader. It was part of the Richmond newspaper system. And I got to tell you, for an alcoholic, for a 19-year-old alcoholic, there wasn't a better place in the world to go work, because newspapers still had a lot of old union guys that drank every day, all day long. And you couldn't get the union out of there with a shotgun. So I kind of just fell right into a wonderful thing. And it was, for my alcoholic mind, it was great work. We put out five deadlines a day. And you basically sat around and did nothing, and then it turned into intense chaos for about 45 minutes. And you put a newspaper away, and then you went back to doing nothing. Then I went and drank lunch, and I came back and did that three more times. And it was ideal. I really did well in it. I got to tell you, I guess in retrospect I should say it was a horrible place for me to be, but for a young alcoholic it was a wonderful place to be. However, I desired greater things than they were willing to offer. And I'm one of these alcoholics that believe that you should start at the top and then work your way up. And I wanted to be, like an editor, and they wanted me to actually go to college and get an education. And I don't do things the way I'm supposed to, so I quit. And, no one was standing at the door to beg me to stay. Because I was obnoxious, and I was arrogant, and I was strong-willed. I was capable of working within their deadline system, and most people aren't, so they tolerated that behavior. So I left the newspaper and did what every intelligent person does. Without a nickel in my pocket, I left for California. And I just continued blossoming as an alcoholic. I was with a bunch of guys out there, and we were all homeless, penniless. We scraped together one night $6 to stay at a hotel on the Strip in Hollywood that today they wouldn't let open. It's probably still a $6 hotel. That's how bad it was. And we had no money. But I'm an alcoholic, and I need to drink. And I have clear-cut ideas of how I want to accomplish my objectives, knocking on the door, asking for the cookie. And so I've got my only set of clothes. Everything else I have has been locked up by various people and places. I take a shower with my clothes, so they're clean. When they dry off, I start walking up Sunset Strip. I get to the Beverly Hilton. I walk in, sit down at the bar, and say to, I will never forget, Eric, the bartender, give me a wild turkey on the rocks. Had one, had another, had several more. And when it got, I said, give me my check. He gave me a check, and I wrote down a hotel number on it and walked out the door. And that's how I drank. I had no thought of consequences, no thought of the fact that I was committing a wrong. I hope somebody, whoever hotel number it was, didn't get too surprised at the $85 bar tab they got the next day when they checked out. But that's what I did. That's how I operated my life. At the request of my family, I did go back to college and majored in philosophy to guarantee I could never actually get a job with the education I was getting. But I'm an alcoholic. And so at the beginning of my senior year, I dropped out of college because I don't like to finish things. It's just not in my personality. I start out like the shuttle leaving Cape Canaveral, but I never make it to the outer atmosphere. I just go right into the ocean. It's just part of the nature of me. In fact, I can remember when Sammy and I got married, one of our wedding gifts was a outdoor grill. And I'd been sober, 3 or 4 years. And she was at work one day, and I said, well, I'm going to put this together, and I'm going to follow the instructions. This was a new event for me. It took me hours to read the instructions, understand them, and put part A with part B. But when I got through, there were no extra parts, which is unusual for anything I put together. And it worked. The wheels were on correctly. It rolled. The lid came up. It turned on. And I think that's the first time in my life I ever followed the directions for anything. So I dropped out of school and I went into business in New Hampshire. live free or die. I lived free. I did not die. It was the first time I ever lived permanently a long way from family. And that just skyrocketed me into long-term daily drinking. And I was not a successful business venture, and part of it was my fault and part of it wasn't. But I know that it had a much greater chance of success if I wasn't an active alcoholic. I never thought of that when I was losing the business, but when I was losing the business, I would be at 10:30 in the morning across the street at Daly's Pub having my first store-bought drink of the day, not thinking about the fact that I could actually be prospering in business. I drank above my means when I lived up there, and I learned the economics of drinking very well, which is check kiting and operating a series of bar tabs that are staggered so that there will always be one place that will give you free booze until you can get some money and pay off the other bar tabs. And, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I don't think about long-term solutions to these deals. I just know that I'm keeping booze in front of me. I mean, I'm living one day at a time. That's exactly what I'm doing. And all that matters about that one day is that I have enough to drink. There was one fine institution that I had graced on every single day for 2 years. The owner came up to me one evening and said, "Mark, there's no chance you'll ever be able to pay this bar tab off." That was neither a shock nor a source of concern for me. The booze was already in my system. And he said, "However, I have a solution to this. I'm going to let you work to pay your bar tab off, and what I'll get you to do is you're going to tend bar for me. And I'm going to pay you by the hour, and I'm going to keep that, and you can keep the tips you get." So here I am, weighted down by the burden of paying off my bill, and I'm behind a bar. And I've got a beer at this end, and I've got a beer at this end, and I've got a speed rack full of whiskey here. And I'm thinking, "My God, I hope this lasts forever." It was a wonderful experience. I mean, only alcoholics fall face down and get up with such regularity. But now I'm in my mid-20s and I am a daily drinker. And when I say daily drinker, I'm not looking at the clock and saying, "Oh, it's 5 o'clock somewhere." I get up in the morning and, excuse me, when I go to iron a shirt, I have a couple of shots of bourbon while I iron that shirt. Because it just eases you into the day. I mean, I was at the point in my life where I couldn't drink beer anymore because I just couldn't consume the calories the beer had. And the economics of drinking are such that you can get 25 drinks out of a bottle more than you can out of the cans. And, you know, I mean, it's all about dollars and cents. And I needed to find a job in Richmond, Virginia. And what does an alcoholic do for a living when he needs the freedom to drink? Well, I tell you, I took a left turn from the land of philosophy to the land of car sales. In 1982, the market was even worse than it is now. The best interest rate you could get on a car loan was about 19%. You couldn't scare people into coming in to buy cars. But I'm going to start out my career as a car salesman. And the guy that was the leading salesman of the month for the previous 3 months in this dealership, which is a very well-respected dealership, was actually on work release for cocaine distribution. So I knew that if they were going to tolerate him, my having the occasional tipple while I worked wasn't going to be a big deal. And true to form, in the car business, if you can sell cars, you can be John Wayne Gacy, and they'll overlook, you know, the occasional need to bury something under your house. And I stayed in that business for 7 years, and I climbed the ladder. I went from salesman to finance manager to sales manager, and it was great. I would pick out the guy that I was going to fire at the end of the month, and I'd send him for my booze every night, because he wasn't going to make it anyhow, so what the heck. You know, and I'd run these guys around. "You fill up my car with gas, you do this, go to the bank for me," on and on. And the dealership's happy because I'm doing my job, and I am I got two offices. I got one in the old building where the used cars are, and I got the main showroom. And I go to my old office, and it's got a wall full of George Dickel that wholesalers and so forth bring me as kind of gifts. Please remember me when you have trading. Then I have a little George Dickel, and I go back to the main showroom and, you know, act very civil, and I shake hands with customers and thank them for their business and berate salesmen and do whatever you have to do. And then I go back to my office, get a little more lubrication, and I go back up, and there's somebody who's got a lemon. And when you're in the sales manager in the car business, if there's somebody who's bought a lemon, before they ever talk to the owner who can do something about it, you have to be punched by these people for 4 or 5 days to kind of soften them up. And that's okay, because once that's through, I go back to my office on the other side of the bed and I get a little drink, and I just, and that's what I did. And the only reason I left that whole operation was because it dawned on me that I deserved and needed more money. I mean, you know, it's 1985, 1986. I'm making $45,000, $50,000 a year. I'm renting a house for $500. I got to pay the utilities. Car dealership has paid every other expense I have. They feed me. They pay for my car. They pay for my insurance. I don't have a nickel to my name. I'm working 6 days a week. It's not like I'm going to Vegas and blowing it. The only thing I do is play golf on Sundays and drink every day of the week, and I have no money. And I only have one solution, because I'm an alcoholic, and that's to get more money. It would never have dawned on me. Perhaps you could cut back. Perhaps you could start living, you know, a regimented normal life, you know. Perhaps you could pay a little more attention to your family members. Perhaps, perhaps, perhaps. No. I'm an alcoholic. I drink when I want. I drink to the effect I want, and I drink with no regard to other people. And I do it without shame. So I went back into business for myself as an independent medical rep. Because you make more money. And another nice thing was you get to travel a lot. It's always nice to drink in new places, you know, kind of keeps your attitude up. But I made a strategic error as I did that. I had most everything I wanted as far as the toys went. And I thought I was pretty successful, because you look at my business card and it'd tell you that I was the president of Griffin Company. And what was on my business card is all I really wanted you to know about me anyhow. It didn't say loser on there. That's all that mattered to me. And I never had a habit of picking women up in bars. It just wasn't. I mean, I was. That's not to say that I wasn't manipulative and disingenuous and willing to say anything, because I was. I'm just like every other dog of a man that was out there drinking. But I had different tactics. When I was at Virginia Commonwealth University, it came to my attention that there was a whole crew of women called art history majors. And you would never find them in bars, but if you went to the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, it was like a magnet for them. And if you walked up to the Chinese Museum exhibit and said something about this is the presence of the Tao in this artwork, well, 20 minutes later, you were in a bar and you were having a good time with some woman who was apparently unaware that I only had one purpose in life outside of drinking. I got to tell you that as I got sober and I went through the steps, there were a lot of amends I could never make, because I wasn't a moral person. I wasn't a good person. And there were a lot of women who either had been married or were married who I could never make amends to. There were a lot of people that I just stomped on as I was going through my little drinking career that I never gave any thought to. There were a lot of sins of omission rather than commission that I needed to pay attention to. And it was difficult for me to come to grips with that. How do I make amends for all of that? And my sponsor told me the only way I can do that is by living life properly now. That has to be good enough for me, because I can't do anything else. So that's what I try and do today. At any rate, I walked into a bar one night and I met this attractive looking woman, and 5 months later we were married. And she drank kind of like I did, which was hard and fast. The nice thing was that she passed out relatively quickly in the evening, so I could consume some peaceful alcohol before I stumbled off to bed. And this was probably a guarantee that my life was going to unravel a bit, because relationships based on instantaneous gratification and alcohol just aren't going to last. I mean, that's just the nature. But I had this great big territory. I covered from like Galax, Virginia to Boston and as far west as Nashville. So when the heat got a little hot at home, I'd pack a suitcase and say, I'm going to go work Nashville for a week. And I'd find a nice, quiet hotel where I could sit there in my boxers and drink bourbon and smoke cigarettes and watch ESPN without anybody telling me what I was doing wrong with my life. And that's how I handled a relationship. That was my ability to cope. Run, and run some more. And, I didn't realize it until a couple of years later, but I was physically starting to deteriorate. I don't know if I was the biggest drinker on the planet. I doubt I was, but I drank everything that my body could tolerate. And in 1993, my body started to break down. I'd gotten to the point where I started my day, regardless of what I was going to do later in the day, my body would wake me up at 5 o'clock in the morning because it had frankly been without alcohol long enough. Because I'd been in bed, like at 1 o'clock. And I would walk downstairs and out the front door, and I'd reach into my car, and underneath the seat would be a plastic bottle of pop-off vodka. It was about $2 a pint then. And I had those things wedged under my seats. They made no noise. They were great, what I call drinking material. And I'd drink about 3 or 4 fingers out of that, and I'd walk into the driveway, and I'd light a cigarette. And if I didn't vomit or explode, my day was about as good as it was going to get. I would go inside, and I'd wait for my wife to get up. And when she'd see me just like she saw me every other day. Skin was a little more yellow, maybe. The eyes were red. But you know what? I was earning a good paycheck, so everything can't be all bad. And I would decide, am I going to drink more now? And not make sales calls, just get on the phone and touch bases with people and maybe make a little money that way. Take a little nap around 1 o'clock, go houses on a golf course, watch a few golfers curse at their balls, relax, get up in time to go to the liquor store, be home before the old lady got home, so everything looked the same. Or I'd actually go out and work. Well, the days that I'd actually go out and work were decreasing. But I had worked very hard when I started that business, and I had a lot of good relationships in hospitals. And I got to tell you, it amazes me that I did, because I drank all during that. The only day that I wouldn't drink would be if I had to be in an OR the next morning. Operating rooms are very difficult places to be badly hungover in. The oxygen level is low. The humidity seems to be high. You're sitting there with a mask on. I wore glasses then. They were constantly getting fogged up. I've got a surgeon from an indeterminate country who I can't understand to begin with asking me questions. And he's talking into the open belly of somebody. And all I can do is think to say yes, and just pray that I can get out of there and get a drink in me. I mean, the number of times I left hospitals like Georgetown and had a bottle to my lips before I ever got out of the parking lot because I had to have it. I was no longer at the point where I wanted to have it. Oh, I wanted to have it, but I had to have it. I couldn't live without alcohol. My body could not live without alcohol. But times were getting tough. My body was breaking down. I had the shakes all the time. And I just knew I had to stop drinking. But I'm a Griffin. And Griffins do things by willpower. I mean, that's what I'd learned. My father put himself through college during the Depression. Fought in World War II as a nose gunner in a B-24. We did things by willpower. So I made a decision to quit drinking. And I stopped. And a day and a half or so after I stopped, I was getting up Saturday morning. I was going to go get a newspaper. And normally I would go get a newspaper and a six-pack of beer to just kind of coax into the Saturday rhythm of things. I never got the chance because I had a grand mal seizure. My body wasn't going to tolerate this "we're going to stop drinking" business. And I don't recall what happened during this grand mal seizure. My now former wife contends that I tried to kill her and she escaped. Several hours later, I was on the couch in the living room, and I woke up, and there were two police officers in the room with me, trying to convince me quietly to get into the ambulance. Two guys with guns ask you to get in an ambulance, you get in the ambulance. I don't care what kind of drunk you are, you can't be that stupid. And they put me on this gurney, and I start wheeling out the front door, and all of my neighbors are in a little semicircle around this ambulance watching me come out. And I'm thinking, wow, this is all about me. And, you know, they all knew what kind of drunk I was. I would walk around the neighborhood on Saturdays and Sundays with a pint bottle in my back pocket because I could go to somebody's house with no alcohol. We're not going to let that happen. Put me in the ambulance. We started taking off towards the hospital. And I asked the ambulance attendant if they could turn the siren on. Been in a lot of ambulances, never been on the siren on. And I think they were starting to get a little concerned about my mental stability. So, whip, on went the siren, and I got to enjoy the ride to Johnson Willis Hospital. And I really think that that was the beginning. The beginning of the end, and the chance for a new beginning for me was when I got there. My family doctor still did rounds in that hospital, and when they saw his name on my chart, they paged him. And he came down to the operating room, or the emergency room, and he looked at me. And, you know, I've known the guy for years and years, and we would have this one conversation all the time, no matter when I went to see him. At 10 o'clock in the morning, he'd say, "Have you been drinking?" I'd say, "Yeah." 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he'd say, "Have you been drinking?" I'd say, "Sure, I just had lunch." Today, that day, he asked me, "How much do you really drink?" And I told him. And I felt an enormous emotional release when I told him that. But I'm an alcoholic, and here's the way my mind works. 5 minutes later, they were backing my head into a CAT scan to see if there was a physiological problem for my seizure. And I remember thinking, maybe I'll have a brain tumor and I can still drink. That's where I was. That's where I was in 1993. This hospital was a client of mine. I knew doctors there. I knew nurses and clinicians there. They got me a nice little room all by myself. And I proceeded to humiliate myself in front of them. For the first couple of days, every day they had to send somebody in the parking lot to find me because I'd be bumming cigarettes from people in my pajamas, just wandering through the parking lot. They'd come and get Mark, take him back inside. We reached an agreement that I could smoke in my bathroom if I promised to stay in the hospital. And then the next day, they came in and I was leaning against an oxygen port having a Marlboro. End of agreement. And it's alleged that at 2 o'clock in the morning, I threatened to punch a nurse for waking me up. I don't recall that incident. But the next day, Mrs. Griffin and a very squirrely-looking little man came into the room to see me. And I will tell you that if I were sitting in a bar, half in the bag, and I saw this guy walk in, I would say, "That's a psychiatrist." But I was non-compos mentis. I was in diminished capacity. I had no idea who he was. But he started to ask me questions, and I didn't think that they were pleasant questions. A little bit rude about them. I thought it was quite intrusive. But the gist of the whole interview process was that the hospital was not going to let me stay there anymore, and my wife wasn't going to let me come home because she had no clue what ceiling I was going to be climbing on. So they sent me to the Nut Hut. They say that I agreed to that. I have no idea. My mind was just mush at that point. As a matter of fact, they gave me Librium to keep me from having another seizure in the hospital. And a week later, there were still traces of Librium in my bloodstream. My liver just could not process anything anymore. And, you know, I always felt like that was an intrusive and unwarranted event by my wife and this psychiatrist. And a couple of years ago, I had to get all my medical records together for a little deal with the government. And since they're my medical records, I thought I'd relive my dicey little medical history and looked at them. And that was the interview that this doctor gave me. What I thought this was this very intrusive and antagonistic interview. He wrote down four words. Goal-focused and delusional. That's all he had to say about me. He's absolutely right. Not just about me wanting to go home, but about how I lived my entire life. I was goal-focused. I went after everything I wanted. I got what I wanted. And I was delusional to think that that was a way you could live life, that there was any way to have a satisfactory, decent life out of that. So now I'm in the Ha Ha Hotel, and I'm not happy. Not happy. I can tell you, I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning, my first morning there, and I'm not Brad Pitt. I'm not saying that I am, but the nurse that woke me up was one of the homelier human beings I've ever seen. And she woke me up to tell me that I needed to make my bed when I got out of it. And I said, with the money you people are getting, you should probably be in this bed with me. That was my attitude about being in treatment. I was not happy. And the reason why I wasn't happy was I knew I couldn't drink anymore. And I had no idea. No idea how I was ever going to live. I mean, I didn't see any hope. When you start to despair, what we find out as we've gone through these things is that you can never really find hope until you've found despair. They're almost connected. And after I had been there for 4 or 5 days, one evening they took 4 of my fellow inmates, and one of them I'm still friends with, but the other 3 I think have drifted long since back out into the world. And they loaded me into a van, and we just took off for downtown Richmond. And I'm thinking, this is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest here. I'm going to be out in public with these other lunatics. And we pulled up to the Madison Street AA Club, 210 Madison Street. And that was my first AA meeting. And I got to tell you, I wasn't at all excited about that. But you could smoke inside. And that's all the bait I needed to get in the door. And I got to tell you that I have no clue what that guy spoke of that night. That was a speaker meeting. I have no idea. But when I left there, I had hope. On the way down there, I had no hope. I sit in a room. I have no idea what they're saying. I leave. I have hope. I have my first evidence that there's a spiritual solution to this program. I didn't think that then, but that, in fact, is the case. So I got transferred a short while later from inpatient to outpatient. And I saw my chart, and what they wrote on my chart when they turned me over was good luck. Because none of them had any confidence that I had a prayer of ever getting sober or staying sober. I'll never forget, there was a lady being checked in the day that I got to go on the other side of the door with no handles. And she told me she was coming in for her 50th time. And I said, that's not going to happen to me. I may drink and die or get well, but I'm not coming back here ever again. These people don't let you have caffeine. They don't let you have sugar. You've got to fight to have a cigarette. Why would you want to come back here? I mean, it's insanity. But they told me the first thing I needed to do when I got out was go to an AA meeting. The next thing I needed to do was to get a sponsor. So I went to the Beulah 12 and 12 that night, not really sure of exactly what was going to happen. And it probably wasn't a great meeting for a new alcoholic to be in. It was a step meeting, and they were doing, you know, like tradition 8, just, you know, face down on the table asleep. But at the end of it, I needed to pick up a white chip. They asked if anybody wanted to pick a white chip, so I got up. And the guy standing up there with the chips was a biker, I guess. He was about 6'3 or 6'4, had long, stringy hair, a wife beater T-shirt on. And as I got closer to him, it became apparent that he was wearing perhaps the last known bottle of High Karate cologne in the world. And he was wearing all of it. So, you know, I was obviously willing to get a white chip because I let this guy hug me. And there were tears running down my face. And they weren't gratitude. Wandered back to my little table there. And I sat down, and the guy sitting next to me, I just looked at him and I said, would you be my sponsor? Because they told me to get a sponsor. I didn't know what sponsorship was. I didn't know what it entailed. I didn't know that people went through the process of interviewing prospective sponsors and so forth. And he said, I don't know. I've only been sober a year. Why don't we just say I'll be your temporary sponsor? And I said, fine. And the next meeting I went to was the Bottom of the Barrel, which is my home group. Been my home group for over 16 years. And Michael was there. And I've been seeing Michael, my sponsor, at that meeting nearly every single Friday night for the last 16 years. And it is one of the tethers that keeps me from drifting off into the world if I want to do it my own way. My sponsor was not a nice man. Not in any scratch of the matter. If I came to him with complaint, he would simply say, here's $5, go get drunk. I came to him the day my wife kicked me out. I said, Michael, my wife kicked me out. He said, here's the keys to the church. Now you got something to do Friday night. I just need to occupy a few more nights for you. Michael doesn't, we're not getting touchy-feely at any time. But I tell you what, I would do anything in the world for that man. Because he helped me get sober. He helped me stay sober. He's seen me through some tough times. Stumble along through sobriety, and I finally start working the steps. I mean, I've been sober a year, but I get that kind of grace period that sometimes alcoholics get, where we come in and we work the first three steps and we get just healthy enough to breathe and function, and we don't do anything else. And I got scared. It dawned on me that I was on thin ice, that I needed to do the rest of the steps. So I did a fourth step. I did a fifth step. And my sponsor looked at me and said, now you get to go find somebody to help. Because that's how this works. If I help you, you go help somebody else. At the same time, my first wife decided that she'd had enough. She didn't like me sober any better than she did drunk. I'd given up my business because I didn't want to be on the road all that time trying to stay sober. Became a stockbroker. Still a great business card. Here I am, Mark Griffin, financial advisor. And, you know, I went from having a nice house on the golf course and two cars and a boat and a truck and all that stuff to one day later being unemployed, living in an unfinished attic. I had my golf clubs, a color TV, and my dog. And that was it. Everybody else I knew just went ahead and lost everything while they were drinking. You know, life got a little better as they got sober. I can't do things the right way, apparently, so I lost everything I had while I was getting sober. And it's the best thing that ever happened to me. You know, I'm convinced today, more than ever, that there's a spiritual solution in this program. And what I'm convinced of today is it's more important than any other part. Now, that may not be true. It's just my opinion. But I know people that get sober, and what they do is they work in sobriety. I'm going to mix coffee at this meeting. I'm going to put up chairs at this meeting. I'm going to do this and this and this and this and this. And as long as they're busy, they're okay. And when they're not, there's this kind of dry, arid sobriety that makes them uncomfortable to be around and unhappy. And I didn't want that. So I'm stuck here in this unfinished attic, and I'm reading the big book, and I get down on my knees, and I'm praying, and God finally could get through to me, because I didn't have all the stuff. I didn't have a job. I didn't have my toys. I didn't have my image. I didn't have anything. And all of a sudden, it made sense to me. It made perfect sense to me. You know, it says in the big book that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem. I'd probably read that 100 times. I actually highlighted it while I was in the Nut Hut because I thought it would be an important... If they're given a test, I wanted to be able to tell them that. But it never made any sense to me. And then one night, it did, 1995. And it radically changed the way I lived, the way I thought about other people, what mattered to me in life and what was important to me. And, you know, it's the incredible thing is that without my asking, God replaced everything that I thought he took away from me, but better. I wasn't looking for another wife, another house on the golf course, or anything at that point. I was just doing my best to get a hold of this idea that there is a God, and that he is control of everything, and that all I have to do is get up today and live, and the rest of it he'll take care of. And I started walking that walk, and I started talking that talk, and amazing things started to happen in my life. It just astounds me that once I gave up control of my life, I was truly free. I always thought when I had control of everything, I was free to live my life as I wanted. And I never felt true freedom until I surrendered, truly surrendered my will and my life to God. It's the greatest freedom I've ever known. It's pretty remarkable that he has an agenda that I don't have to know. You know, Thomas Merton says that the definition of humility is that no matter how great my plan is, God has a better plan. And I really do believe that's true. My theory today is that nothing can go wrong until you start planning things anyhow. So I started, my brother and I opened up a pharmacy. It's a good thing I'm not a drug addict, but I'm not. So I spent my day wandering along the 1,000, pill bottles of Valium and so forth. And it was a pretty interesting thing, but a crazy thing happened on the way to sobriety. This lady who I'd seen for a number of years in the program of AA invited me to go to a retreat with her to play golf. That's all she wanted was to play golf. Now, in the back of my brain, you know what happens to this alcoholic, but I had not met my firmest opponent yet. So we went up to this grade, which is a Shenandoah Roundup. We've been going there for a number of years. We played golf. She beat me. She ran over my foot with a golf cart. She was loved by everybody there. And, you know, it was really amazing. These men were kind of like protecting her from me. They didn't know who I was. But one guy walked up to me and said, "When did you get sober?" I just wanted to say, "Tuesday." You know, what's it to you? But she was being taken care of. But I really liked her. Well, that first night we were there, we sat up and talked until about 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was the first time in my life I'd ever been in a room with a woman with my clothes on at 2 o'clock in the morning. And so when we got back, I started to call her, and she was not particularly interested in seeing me again. But I attack and I conquer and I loot as an alcoholic. I still had no idea what a relationship was or what it constituted, but I tried. And I would go over and see Sammy, and I'd be there for a half hour, and she'd say, "It's time to go." And I'd be standing out in the hall with a door on my face. This is not working out like I planned. Finally, one day, I got into my 100,000-mile, 12-year-old pickup truck, and I was driving home, and I thought, why am I going to put myself through this? I mean, this is just too much work. And God said to me, "Why don't you just let me take care of it? Why don't you do things my way?" And I quit trying, and about a year later, we were married. We've been married for almost 13 years now. It's a gift of sobriety that I have a partner in life who is more than a wife. She's my friend. We've traveled all of this country together, and we'd just as soon be together as anything else in the world. And it's a gift of this program. That's all there is to it. I don't know how. I still am shocked, but we ended up owning a restaurant a few years later. I had never thought first. I couldn't cook. I had no idea how to cook. I spent 20 days with a guy. And after 20 days, he said, "If you want to buy the restaurant, it's yours. I know you can do it." I was working for Walgreens. I had just enough money in my stock portfolio to put down in the restaurant, to the penny. 20 days after I've seen this guy and shaking his hand, I'm now running a restaurant with my wife. And, you know, it's a tremendous attribute to have a good relationship that's based on understanding and communication. Because if you're in the restaurant business together and you can't, you'll be attacking each other with knives at the end of the first week. It's a tough, tough business to be in. But the real benefit of owning that restaurant was all the other things that it gave us the time and effort to do. We've been to two of the last two internationals, and they're phenomenal events. If you ever get a chance to go to one, if you want to see what it's like to sit with 50,000 sober alcoholics in one place, It's pretty amazing. It really is. And we're going to go to San Antonio next year, God willing. I will only tell you that the journey that Alcoholics Anonymous has set me on is a journey that begins every day, all over again. It's not something I chase, I can conquer, that I can grab a hold of and say, I did this, it's mine. Every day I get up and there's a little package next to me. It's a gift from God. I've got a choice. I can open the gift or I can walk right by it. If I open it up, what I get every day is God's grace. And if I do that, every day is a good day. And it truly is a blessing to be able to live life that way. I don't have to worry about yesterday. I don't have to worry about tomorrow. Today's the only day I've got. I may as well make the best of it I can. I have one way of describing what alcoholism is to me, and with that, I'll let you folks go. In the big book, there was a guy named Saul. And Saul was basically a lawyer, and he liked rules. He was a rule keeper. And one of the rules he kept was the rules for stoning, and he would hold the coats of other people while they stoned people to death. Wasn't a nice man. He's on his way to Damascus one day, and he had a Bill Wilson-like experience. God knocked him off the horse and onto his butt and said, why are you doing this to me? I'm going to change your life. And he did. Changed his name to Paul, put him in the witness protection program, gave him a little education, sent him out to change the world. Paul did remarkable, incredible things. He basically set the course of history for Europe by taking his evangelism there. You'd think a guy that had done that much for God could get a little break, but he had a thorn in his side. And he asked God to remove it. And God said, no, my grace is sufficient to carry you. And just like I would have done, he asked God two more times for the same thing. Will you remove this thorn in my side? God said, no, my grace is sufficient to carry you. I know today that alcoholism is the thorn in my side. But I also know that his grace and the gift of this program is sufficient to carry me. Thank you very much for having me.